Hello, and welcome to Such a Nightmare, Conversations About Horror. My name is Catherine Troyer, and joining me is Anthony Tresca.
Hello there.
This is a podcast devoted to thoughtful discussions about that fine line between the horrific and the horrible. Each episode looks at a specific horror text that is, for better or worse, giving us nightmares.
And this week, we are excited and very thankful to have you all joining us for our episode on It, Chapter 2.
Most of our episodes, we're doing It Chapter 2 a little differently because the film just came out. Mm-hmm. We just saw it yesterday, and that means that our own impressions are still sort of raw, but it also means that there's very little that we can bring in about, the critical reception because it's still settling and being determined.
Or even larger, like the scholarly reception.
Exactly, because there just isn't in it yet.
No academics have sat down to write their hot takes
on It Chapter 2. On a film that's been out for like 48 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. God. Academics, you're so slow. Everything takes so long.
I know. That's how you know it's done right.
So before we get into talking about It, Chapter 2, we should begin with a little bit of framework.
And you should also brace yourself for tons of puns that Anthony's just going to make throughout this entire episode.
Yeah, I realized after listening back, I promised a lot of puns on the name, and I really failed to deliver last episode, so I'll get it. Back in there. Start get it up.
So anytime you hear that pause, just know you're supposed to chuckle.
Yeah.
or Anthony will chuckle for you. So with a PhD in humanities and specifically focusing on the horror genre, I'm constantly looking for, how the texts that I'm watching and enjoying or struggling to enjoy are engaging with various theoretical frameworks. And I wanted to do one that is not, as we said, specific to It Chapter 2, because there's not much out there yet. And it's not even specific to the horror genre. It's just one that works really nicely and I think is unavoidable when we're going to talk about any version of It, and that is the idea of adaptation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of adaptation studies start and sometimes unfortunately end with just questions of faithfulness.
Yeah, with the fans being like, it didn't look exactly how I imagined it in my head. They left out this one character wearing a scarf in this scene.
Yeah, exactly.
It ruined the integrity of the novel.
And so then questions become, does it need to be that faithful? Couldn't he not have a scarf this, one time?
How faithful is too faithful?
Or are we talking about faithfulness when it comes to, details, or are we talking about faithfulness when it comes to the spirit of things? Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a fantastic scholar named Linda Hutchin who argues that maybe we should just sort of accept that that's not really the conversations we should be having, or certainly not limiting our conversations
about adaptations. I'm confused. Are you telling me that books and films are two different mediums and we should treat them as such?
I know. It is rather mind-blowing.
No, as a fan, I just would rather scream about how it doesn't look exactly as it does in my head.
And as a fan, I want to do that too. But as a scholar, I try my hardest to be like, no, that makes sense. Because what she says is, and I really like this way of thinking of it, that one of the nice ways to think of an adaptation is first off to think of it as its own creature, right? Mm-hmm. And that it does have this connection to the past. It is speaking to this previous text, but it's also speaking and adding its own conversation. But I like this idea of it thinking of an adaptation, as Hutchin suggests, as a translation.
Interesting.
Because what that does is it allows for us to think about, so what if a translation means that we're having to think, how do we translate this content for today's audience? Mm-hmm. How do we translate this content for today's issues? And how do we translate that content into this new medium? And I think it's just kind of a nice way to think about it, because I realize that both my praises of It Chapter 2 and my big criticisms kind of all stem from issues connected to adaptation and places where they succeeded in translation and places where I think they failed.
Because you didn't like that in some scenes they weren't wearing exactly as it was described in the book.
And yes, exactly.
Those are your problems.
Yes.
That's actually it. We're just going to be talking about clothing accessories.
Yeah,
today.
My whole issue is that, if Bill's going to be bald in the novel, he has to be bald in the show, in the movie,
And James McAvoy has already proved that he's willing to go bald. He did it in Split. I just don't understand why they couldn't be more faithful.
Exactly. That's all we're going to talk about. Of course, we're joking. Hopefully you're not turning off the podcast because you're thinking that's all we're going to do.
We are just joshing here.
We want to talk, though, about, just the fact that there's some really places where this film shined, and unfortunately a lot more places where The Shining did not happen. Ha ha ha, pun.
Yes, that was very good.
Thank you.
You stole my jokes, though. Yes. My things are puns.
No, I've taken it, and I succeeded masterfully because it wasn't on purpose. Wahaha.
Curses. Foiled again by intelligence.
So Anthony tries to always do something that I forget to do, and that is to ground our episodes in the, like, reception and the production side of things. So what do you have for us for It Chapter 2?
Well, It Chapter 2, 2019 film, directed by Andy Muschietti and written by Gary Doberman. These are two people who also worked on It Chapter 1. Andy Muschietti, of course, being the director, and Gary Doberman was one of the many writers on It Chapter 1, unlike that first one. It Chapter 2 only has the one writer. Talks of the sequel to It Chapter 1 began before that first film was even released, because, I mean, you kind of have to, with It being an absolute behemoth of a novel. You have to make some decisions.
It's over 1,100 pages.
Yeah.
And so you do have to make some decisions. And I think one of the places where perhaps we already set ourselves up for problems was this decision to split the two chapters the way they did.
Indeed. With the first chapter focusing only on the kid versions of the novel and not having any elements of their adult counterparts, but then this chapter trying to intertwine them.
Yes.
So this film, It Chapter 2, was announced officially in September of 2017, and filming began in June of 2018. And as you alluded to earlier, we've made my job very difficult to gather critical reception, because critical reception is still actively being developed. But I will still persist anyway. Reviews on Rotten Tomatoes right now, the critic score is a 65%, which isn't incredible, but it's not damning. The Metacritic score is a 58. The Rotten Tomato audience score is an 80%, and the Metacritic audience score is a 6.7. And the film got a cinema score of a B+, which is actually the same cinema score as It Chapter 1.
I think that I like the film as much as I do, because I'm determined to like it, if that makes sense. Like, I so badly want to enjoy this film, because It Chapter 1 just makes my heart happy. I think it's a near flawless film. It does have its flaws, and you can listen to our podcast episode on it if you want, but it is so close.
It is a good time.
Stop it. but like, this film just, I kept thinking, no, it'll get better, because he knows what he's doing, right? Andy Muschietti knows what he's doing. We've seen it before. We've seen good work. And there were some good things.
Yeah, and I think that's a great place to start, because we don't want to just harp on this film. It does do some stuff really well. So let's start with some of the good. Particularly, I would like to single out a performance. I think Bill Hader's version of Richie is quite remarkable.
Yes, I would agree very much so. In fact, I think that he does that Richie I like even better than I like the child version.
Indeed.
And that's not always the case with the other characters in this film.
Yeah. I mean, and that's nothing against Finn Wolfhard.
No, he does good.
Also does a good job as Richie, but
it felt seamless. It felt like this is what the adult version of Finn Wolfhard would look like,
and
would act like, and would be.
I think that's interesting, because Bill Hader is one of the actors who Finn Wolfhard actually said he would like to play him. All of the kids got asked in a press junket, like, which actor they would like to have play them. And two of their picks actually got chosen. Finn Wolfhard, who played Richie, actually did pick Bill Hader. And then the girl who played Bev, Sophia, she said that she would like to have Jessica Chastain play her. And both of them did end up getting cast. Some of their other picks from the other ones are also quite interesting. The actor who played Mike chose Chadwick Boseman. The actor who played Stanley chose Joseph Gordon-Levitt. The actor who played Ben chose Chris Pratt, which would have been an interesting pick. One who played Bill chose Christian Bale. And the one who played Eddie chose Jake Gyllenhaal.
And, you know, I actually thought that James Ranson did a fine job as adult Eddie.
As adult
in
Eddie.
In part because of the chemistry between adult Richie and adult Eddie.
Oh,
not really. They stole the show in a film that I'm not sure that should have been what happened. Yeah. I think they should have had that component, but I think we should have had equally strong characters from the others, too.
To build a cohesive ensemble.
Yes.
Rather than just basically elevating them to kind of the star players.
Yes. And I think one of the ways in which the film managed to make something richer out of Richie's character. Oh, no. I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm sorry.
You're stealing my jokes.
I know. It is having this sort of more transparent idea that Richie is gay.
Yeah.
So I will say that when at the beginning of the film, when we have the two gay men that are at the festival, someone behind me still felt the need to be like, ew, right? Like, so in 2019, in non-dairy, we still have gross people who feel the need to be super judgmental.
And I mean, I guess that's why, that does just prove that it still is relevant today as it was when King wrote it.
Absolutely. And for that reason, I think it's a smart move to have Richie's character be more openly gay, because in the novel, all he does is there's a moment where after Eddie has died, Richie kisses him on the cheek, kisses his body on the cheek, and then they depart.
Yeah.
And that's really it.
And I mean, Stephen King has been called out for these ambiguously gay characters. Someone actually wrote an article about this on Vocal Media, looking at some of these characters in Stand By Me, The Long Walk, and then, of course, It. There's nothing ambiguous about Richie's feelings in this one.
No, this is not the version of Disney.
Right. It's like in what we're referring to as queer baiting. It's
where you have a character that may or may not be gay, but you know that you're sort of drawing in both audiences by like saying, well, you can pick. And so it's
Schrodinger's gay.
Ha, stop it. Okay. That was actually very clever. So yeah, it really is that, right? And and this film doesn't do that, right? It says very explicitly. But I will say that there are already some people who feel that actually was a weaker component.
Oh, boy. Hot takes.
So in an article that just came out, obviously, in Hollywood Reporter, the author says that they actually feel that it's strange to have Richie in a post-2010 world, right? In the teens of the 21st century, in the entertainment business, being uncomfortable with revealing that he's gay. Mm-hmm. And because there's never a moment where he actually says it, we just see him, re-entering into the wood. The initials of him and Eddie, that kind of takes away from some of the strength that could have been there, because this is not the Richie of the novel, who as an adult is in the 80s in the middle of the AIDS scare. So, and I do agree that they could have just had him say, like, hey, everyone, I'm gay. And then everyone could have been like, yeah, we know. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that would have been such an easy moment in a film that's already long. It would have taken, only a few more seconds to put that in there. So this is a point that is, I think, a great translation of King's work.
Another element that works quite well is the pacing of this film. It's not a film that is afraid to just let you be with the moment.
Yeah, so if we're thinking again, like, how do we translate 1,100 plus pages into a couple of films? This film said, well, let's show you how. We're gonna sort of not be afraid to focus on people when a traditional horror film might have gone to a jump scare. Mm-hmm. We're going to take the time to meander down memory lane, literally and figuratively, and we're gonna find ways to transition between all the stuff that we can't fit in different ways.
And I can only agree with this point to a certain extent, though, because I think they do a really nice job of letting you be with moments earlier on in the film when they're introducing the adult counterparts of these characters who we come to know as the kid versions of them from the first It. But I do not think it does a very good job of this as the film progresses. I think it feels its length. Allow me to make a joke. The tagline of the film is, it ends, but for me, it felt like it would never end.
Stop. Okay, so that is, yeah. I mean, I do have to agree with you somewhat. Like, even if that was the punniest way that you could have said it.
I'll be here all week. Maybe I can be Richie when they inevitably redo this one again.
Nice. That's nice.
I'll be a podcaster this time instead of a stand-up comedian.
I like that. I like that a lot. You start on that, like, adaptation now. But yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a long film. It's a film that does feel, as it progresses, increasingly like, oh, we're still going.
Increasingly indulgent, I would say.
But I do have to say, though, that I like the fact that this film takes time to remind us that what makes King's novel so enjoyable is not just the scary clown. It really is this group and this collective bunch, and unfortunately as the movie shows, it's really the kids, right? Yeah. And we see that. And so I was very grateful that we did not lose those child actors completely, because they make those characters so great. And so having that, I think, was also a great way for the novel to be translated into this new form.
And another element, because they're constantly transitioning back and forth, one element that I think works really well is their use of transitions and cutting to and from and finding really interesting ways to do it. I knew early on they were going to do a good job of it when they had this shot of the stars, but suddenly the stars began to look a little weird, and you came up and you realize you're looking at it through a puzzle.
Yes.
And then you come out, and I was like, wow.
I needed more of that. I really did. I think that if there would have been some more thoughtful attention to the ways that visually we can condense what would have to take pages and pages in a novel,
mm-hmm.
I think that we would have been able to condense a good amount of the script.
I agree with you, but I think that a lot of the transitional work is quite strong.
So let's say that I agree with you. I haven't decided if I do.
I like this.
But let's say that I agree with you in terms of some good transitions. I do want to go back to this idea, though, that I think there were opportunities, wasted opportunities, where they sort of forgot, oh, yeah, we're a visual medium. Mm-hmm. We can do things that the novel couldn't do. And I think one of the ways is that whole sort of elongated section of the scavenger hunt, first off doesn't entirely appear in the novel. The novel, they're each sent off to like re-explore Derry, that is correct, and they do all encounter it, but that could have been done through some fantastic like cross-cutting instead of like, and this is this person's moment and this person's moment and this person's. It could have been so that we kind of see them like Bill and then Ben and then Bev, Bill and then Ben and then Bev, and then onward, and it kind of like, it could have been used so effectively in this moment, but instead it just felt sort of, like you said, a little bit self-indulgent.
Bloated.
Yes.
It's where the film began to really showed me that it didn't quite know what it was doing. It was a very immature thing to do, to just, like, have these 10-minute sequences for each of the characters, some of them are okay. Like, I thought that the Bev scene, even though we saw most of that in the trailers for this film with her interaction with the old woman who is Pennywise, I thought that was a good scene.
Sure.
Even though people in my theater did laugh at that.
Oh, the nakedness?
The nakedness, yeah. Because they, too, are afraid of the female body.
Right, yes.
I think just the Eddie's scene where he goes back to the pharmacy and has to go down, it is one of the weakest scenes in the entire movie because it doesn't quite know. It gets very indulgent in the jump scare nature of it, because they're back-to-back in quick succession. And also, there are some really weird moments of humor in there that do not work with the scene at all. Like when it starts singing that song.
Yeah, the non-diegetic comedic score over. I would have been okay with that if they had that be a sort of recurring element, because they did that in the first film. Right, there were moments, for example, when they're in Ben's bedroom and Bev shuts the door, and then we hear the New Kids on the Block music. So, you know, and that's an instance of them being very smart with their use of comedy and horror together. I think this film was like, oh no, we have to do that because that's been a really successful element of our previous film. But they just because of that, they just didn't always know where to go.
Yeah, and a lot of the jokes for that don't land, or they feel really out of place.
In their defense, and I mean they as in, you know, from Andy Muschietti on down, right? This is the part of the novel, the adult version, that I think is the hardest to adapt. I'm not sure that the 1990s miniseries was as successful with this either.
No.
Because this is the part of the novel. There's a reason that King constantly goes back and forth between the children and the adults, and that the majority of the novel really is about the children, because that's where it sings and that's where it shines, and like you said,
that's where it floats.
Stop it. This is just full of puns. But you're right, that's where it floats successfully, and that hasn't started drowning yet, right? And I think that, like you said, they don't know where they're going because they realize they have this rather insurmountable challenge of making interesting something that is going to be, I think, a struggle because of how effective the children's part of the story is.
I know I said I wasn't going to harp on faithfulness, but there is something that Stephen King's novel gains by not being told chronologically.
And I I think this is where Hutchin would step in and say that it's not that we can't talk about issues of faithfulness, we just have to remember the conversation doesn't begin and end with fidelity. And I think that what you're getting to is you're not saying, I want this because this is how I pictured it in my head. You're saying that the fundamental heart of this story demands this inseparable interplay.
Because it's so clearly about the parallels between these two identical events that are happening 27 years separated. And when you show them in a linear manner, it feels like this, the second time around, feels like a rehash rather than anything new.
And I think it's not just the lack of this, like, sort of back and forth. I think it's also a disconnect between some of the characters and the portrayals of the children and some of the characters and portrayals of the adults.
That was a flawless transition.
Thank you so much.
Just like occurs in It Chapter 2, in my opinion. To next topic of conversation.
Yeah. First, as we said, we felt like the Bill Hader in particular managed to be the same Richie that we needed from beginning to end. Yeah. I think James Ranson did a good job, and there's even that moment where we have that superimposition.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, my gosh.
Wow, they look so similar.
They cast so well. Where we begin to fall flat, I think, is the other members of the Losers Club. Stanley isn't in it enough for us to really talk about.
Yeah.
I really am a fan, normally, of James McAvoy. I just felt like he was flat in this film.
Yeah, and I think that may just be due to his character not being given much to do besides be a stoic leader.
Yes, and of course this is fitting for Bill's character within the novel, but here's again a place where I think the film forgot that it's supposed to be a translation and not just a simple, like, you know, retelling.
Exactly.
I will say, though, that I personally was a fan so very much of his interaction with Stephen King's character.
That was a very funny scene.
And I also was delighted by the constant, like, comments about the, like, that you can't write good endings.
It's true.
Because Stephen King is criticized for that all the time. Because it seems like, a lot of times, he's just like, and then the town, the hotel, the store was destroyed. I mean, it's kind of like his go-to. And so he gets sort of, like, ridiculed all the time for that. So I liked how they were like, yes, yes, we get it. We'll try to fix it. Like, I did appreciate that. But that's independent, really, of James McAvoy's performance.
That was a good moment of writing.
The actor who played Ben, adult Ben.
Jay Ryan.
It was just like they said, okay, well, we need someone who's going to be traditionally attractive
and
masculine.
Let's get a ripped man.
Yeah, and then they were just like, okay, good job. And that was it.
He looked nothing like his child counterpart and acted nothing like his child
counterpart. And I think the actor who plays young Ben, whose name is
Jeremy Ray Taylor,
was fantastic. He was, like, honorable and trustworthy and so intent, and he just, like,
he had a pure spirit about him.
And I think that could have and should have been in the adult version of Ben.
And I know he's supposed to be hardened and he's moved on, he's built new things in his life, but you should still be able to, when he comes back to Derry, the whole point is that you come back to Derry, you're flooded with the memories, you see your child self again, you get all this back. Where was that?
But
not,
you know,
in his performance, that is.
Well, and to be fair, not in the character. And then I'm not sure how I felt about the actor who played Mike, adult Mike.
Isaac Mustafa.
He was fine.
Yeah.
But the problem is, again, the character of Mike. And so now we're going to talk about my two biggest problems in terms of the disconnect between the younger and the older, and that is the character of Mike and the character of Beverly.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike, once again, as I did talk about in It Chapter 1, felt a little bit like a token character.
Yep.
And he does in the novel too, which is a problem. In fact, in the novel, he gets
sidelined.
Yeah, he gets stabbed and sidelined, and then, like, he's just not there for the major confrontation as an adult. So at least they put him in the final battle. But his character, I found very problematic. This idea that, you know, our lone black character is the one that people assume is mad, purposefully duplicitous, stealing things from Native Americans. There was just
they were really playing into a lot of, like, implicit biases.
Yes.
And that's kind of problematic. Not a great move.
No, it's not. And not a move that should be done in a film that's celebrating the, quote, loser.
Exactly.
But where I just
Oh, you can't see it, but she is seething right now.
I am. I just was so disappointed by Bev, and I was disappointed by everything about her, and I had been warned that I was going to be. And it some of it is that I don't think Jessica Chastain was the right actress for this particular role. Yeah. I think that I would have preferred someone who had a little bit more, I don't know, like, humorous quality. Because I think that one of the things that's really important that needed to be translated from the novel is the amount of laughter that comes back into the adults' lives when they're together again. Exactly. I think someone like Amy Adams would have been really good in that role.
She would have been great.
But Jessica Chastain cannot entirely be faulted for a super problematic role where the only things Bev does is she screams.
Yes.
Every time something happens, covers her mouth. At one point, she takes off her coat so she can be a little bit more naked.
Mm-hmm.
And then she becomes, you know, the object of Ben and Bill's affections. Yeah. Which, again, she is in the novel.
That is an element that is problematic in the novel, too.
That's not a good enough excuse.
Nope.
Because if you're going to make an adaptation, you are making a translation.
Just as we mentioned in our podcast on It Chapter 1, where Bev seemed to just be reduced to this type of character, it was much worse than this one, too.
Yes.
Because in It Chapter 1, at least, Bev felt empowered throughout most of it, and so it was a weird choice when she became this object of rally around the flag in the first one. But this one, it was just throughout. It was like, female characters, never heard of them.
Yeah, and it was so disappointing because the actress that plays young Beverly does such a good job of imbuing that character with humor and strength and kindness that we just, to go from a relatively three-dimensional character to an utterly two-dimensional one is not only disappointing, I think it does the film a real disservice.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the problems that we're having with these type of characters is that in It Chapter 1, it felt like a cohesive ensemble, and there was no one who was more important than the other ones. But in this one, I didn't feel the relationships between these people. It felt like big name actors who were just coming together to get a paycheck.
Yes.
And there was a lot of, it was underwritten in terms of the relationships. Like when we got to the end where we were supposed to believe Mike and Bill would get to the point where they say, "I love you, man," and have that moment. I'm like, you didn't do any of the work to get us to this point, though.
No, you're absolutely correct. I think that's an accurate assessment of really that problem. And it's one that again, I think the novel struggles with, but because of that back and forth interplay, it's one that we are willing to embrace. In part because we understand that the characters are confused about how they should feel.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that sense of confusion. I just felt their fright. And I felt their fright over something that honestly was not that frightful.
I agree. I think this film, if it had been overly long, if it had been overly indulgent, I might have forgiven it if it was scary.
Yes. And I realize that at this point, you and I are both a little
desensitized.
Yeah, incredibly desensitized. Because you said that the person you saw it with found it very scary.
I did.
And very engaging, and she does not watch a lot of horror. And I didn't need this to be horrific, as in, like, I'm never going to think good thoughts about humanity again. But at no point was I even mildly scared for two reasons. One, the CGI work.
Good God. We had minor problems with it in the last one.
Yes.
But
minor because they did play with other stuff. They did stuff where they did, you know, models and they
practical
effects.
And Bill Skarsgård's face does a lot of the work in that first one.
Yeah, so, you know, I was very excited for this podcast to be able to talk more about Bill Skarsgård's performance, but we really can't because he was never given an opportunity to perform.
He has one scene with a little girl under the bleachers.
Yeah.
That is really good.
Yeah.
End of conversation about Bill Skarsgård's work in It Chapter 2.
And it's because the film just kept thinking, you know, again, to go back to this issue of translation, they were like, okay, well, there's all of these amazing images that are happening in King's novel. How do we translate them? And they were like, well, we could do it with CGI. No, that's not necessarily the solution. The solution is to remember what the true, and I will say this every episode
what
the true source of horror is.
It is the domestic horror. It is Pennywise's grasp on the town and his ability to make people turn a blind eye to the real horrors that are going on under the surface.
Yes, it is his ability to be that thing that terrifies us so much as a child that we can't even use our words because we haven't been given those words yet. Mm-hmm. And it is the fear of knowing that you can never go back to being a child, that those moments of magic slip away and you can never reclaim them. You can only always be nostalgic. That is what the horror in this novel, a story, is supposed to be. It's what it is in the novel. It is what it is, I think, in large part in It Chapter One.
And that was one of the things we praised a lot about it, is that the domestic horror really worked.
Yes. And then it just fell apart. And I understand, like, let's say you just feel you have to make it a giant spider because you have to be faithful in that one respect. Okay. This film forgot that one of the scariest things as a kid is that thing that we can't see. It's not the actual vision of the monster in the closet. It's knowing there's something in there and we're not going to get to see it. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking about the film as making decisions.
I like thinking about the film.
Very it's good. It's good. Thinking about the film as making decisions in terms of adaptation. There are so many places where it seemed to feel so strongly that I had to stay faithful to its detriment. But there's one place where it went completely in its own direction. Also, I think to its detriment.
Yeah, it's this weird plot thing about the Native Americans and that Native American artifact that really sets in motion a lot of the film.
Yes, and it's the fact that it's the adults doing this.
Yeah.
Sort of like, appropriating a Native American culture.
Mike literally goes and steals a Native American artifact.
Yes, and then drugs his friend.
And then drugs his friend.
In the novel, the kids kind of read something about, like, what Native American peoples would do to create warriors, and they kind of play around in the same way that, right or wrong, most children don't really think about, like, am I appropriating something? They're just thinking about imagination and power.
And it also wasn't Native Americans in the novel.
So the ritual of Chud, you're right, was not Native American. It was Himalayan. They did do in separate ceremony. There's multiple ceremonies in the novel that was Native American, but you're right. It's, I think, important that this is a story that for once is not saying, oh, well, you know, let's just take advantage of the Native American peoples again. But this film just kind of went there in a really weird,
unnecessary
way. And this isn't the only way in which it sort of made some decisions in terms of translation where I think it just missed the mark.
I think that's exactly right. I think that the final coming together in the novel is undeniably weird.
Yes.
It's a battle between Bill, primarily.
And then an adult Richie, too.
Yes. And they team up together, and it's a battle of wills against Pennywise, who reveals its true form, or as close as they can perceive its true form, which is a giant spider. And it's also revealed that it is pregnant. And then it's a battle of wills interdimensionally because a giant turtle, which...
Yeah, we can't even get
into that. You
know
what? Just accept that there's also another magic being.
And it's not
being.
Just the giant turtle. There's another other.
Yes.
Because the turtle died. I mean, like, so it gets really... It would not... They made a smart decision.
Yeah.
When Muschetti and group
good
said...
Good job cutting turtles.
Yes. When they were like, how should we do this? The moment that they were like, well, that would not look good on film, was one of their smartest decisions. Their decision of how to solve that issue and what they decided to project instead was a little problematic.
So we mentioned in the last time when we saw it that it's funny that they're kids and they beat it up through the power of friendship. The power of friendship prevails and they're able to destroy it. In this one, I arguably think it's even dumber.
Yeah, so the thing is that there's that magic that we understand that children have and that there's a magic of childhood friendships that can't be replicated. In this... It becomes this, like, I don't know, I would have even preferred it, honestly, if at the end when they were bullying or anti-bullying it, if they had become the children versions of themselves.
Yeah.
I think that even that I would have had less of a problem with. But yeah, it becomes a sort of anti-bullying message that has not been present throughout any of the rest of the film. Because Henry Bowers' character has been so poorly treated in this film that it's not even about that anymore the way it was in the first one.
That's one of the domestic elements that gets lost.
Yes. And it just feels very lost.
Yeah. It felt like a real, through the power of positive thinking, you can do it. I don't know if any of you have seen Peter Pan, the adaptation on the stage, the musical. But at the end, in order to revive Tinkerbell, Peter Pan asks the audience to clap your hands in Say You Believe in Fairies to revive a Tinkerbell. And that's really what this felt like. It felt like you're just saying you believe you can defeat it, and so you can.
It did, and that was sort of exacerbated by something that I haven't decided how I feel yet, and that is the final, like, letter that Stan sends to all of the grown-up losers. That is the voiceover narration.
Not in the novel.
That is not in the novel. That's only in the film, where he's like, the reason I killed myself is because I didn't think I'd be able to come back, and I knew that I had to remove myself from the equation in order to make sure that you all were successful. And again, it just has a sort of, like, weirdly positive note that wasn't needed, because the novel already has this, like, affirmative feel. Even right. if the adults are forgetting stuff, they've still come out triumphant. It just felt like this, in an effort to, quote, fix an admittedly problematic conclusion of a novel, they made their own super problematic conclusion. I think, as I've been thinking about this film, I realized that it succeeded in something it did not mean to succeed in. At least I assume it didn't. Mm-hmm. And that is that the end of the novel, when you finish it, it's incredibly bittersweet, because all of the adults are forgetting again. Yeah. And it ends with this dream that Bill is having of the friends that were so instrumental in his life that he doesn't remember them during the day. He only remembers them in his dreams. And, like, as an adult reading this, it just, like, it's very nostalgic, and it's bittersweet, and it reminds me that I'll never be a kid again.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like watching It Chapter 2, I was reminded that no matter how much I want it to be, it can never be as good as it was before.
And you're talking about the first film.
And I'm talking about the first film. And the idea that, like, It Chapter 2 made me be the adult that I don't want to be.
Yeah.
In that way, the film was very successful, but I don't think that's the success that it wants to claim.
No. So, all in all, It was a novel idea, but they really dropped the ball in this second chapter.
The circus ball?
Whoa! Yeah. You're really out here clowning around.
No. That's where we have to end the episode. Thank you so very much for joining us.
If you have any special people in your life who like horror, consider recommending us to them and sharing it with them.
Consider checking us out on our social media sites. Our information can be found on our podcast page.
And be sure to join us next time, where we'll be talking about Jordan Peele's 2019 film, Us. Thank you.